Welcome back to The Real Deal. I'm Orbert Davis, and once in a while I get to stretch the rules a little bit. I like to bring my friends in, jazz musicians, and people who make the music happen. And today I'm very honored to have probably someone that you may not have heard of, but someone who makes a difference, not only in the music, but in how the music is perceived and taught as well. My guest today is Willard Jenkins. He's a successful writer, journalist, educator, broadcaster, consultant, and friend of jazz. Willard, how you doing?
I'm great, Orbert. Pleasure to be here.
All right. How do you, first of all, do so many things in the name of jazz?
Well, you know, it's interesting the way it's evolved. I'm not a musician, but so many of the other things related to the music have been of interest to me. And it's just been a matter of trying my hand out at various different things and, you know, finding my own depth within the industry.
Wow. Let's see, I've known you a long time. And how tall are you? You're about 6 foot.
Seven.
Five, 6 foot seven.
Yeah.
So, I would always see Willard at conferences and the sea of people would part whenever he would come into a room. And why jazz? What drew you to jazz? As a journalist, what drew you to jazz?
Well, jazz came first before any of these other aspects, before being a journalist and whatnot. It was jazz that drove me into writing. Essentially, I'm one of those people who was heavily influenced by, you know, the music in the home. Mm-hmm. My father's record collection was the primary influence. And you know, as a kid growing up, I even had a certain proclivity for, even in the case of the pop music that my peers and I were listening to, I even had a proclivity for the instrumental side of those things. Mm. So, you know, it was a kind of an easy evolution to honing in on my father's records and listening to the various selections he had in his collection. And then once I went to college, I had to fill that void and collect my own records.
Okay.
And I went to college at a time when it was a hip thing for people to have a component system. You know,
right.
Everybody had a stereo system in their dorm room or in their apartment and whatnot. That was a mark of good taste. You know, you had to have a stereo system. Nowadays, you know, it's not the same.
Day,
right, exactly. Exactly. But, you know, you had the component system and the thirst for records to keep feeding that turntable. And I guess I'm aging myself in that case,
okay,
because we're going back to records. LPs,
right.
And the need to feed that turntable became almost, it was an obsession.
Uh-huh.
And I got to a point where I was one of those people also who had to have the latest, had
right.
to know what was happening, had to keep my finger on the pulse of what was happening and pick up the latest recordings.
Right.
And, you know, I guess I was old school in that regard too, because I'm one of those people who developed an interest in the music from spending hours in the record store.
Oh, wow.
You know, for example, you know, you'd buy a recording by someone that you really liked, and then you might listen to the record and say, the bass player is really happening.
Right.
Or, you know, that trumpet player, you know, it wasn't him or her that I was buying that recording for, but, wow, that's really someone I should check out. So then you go and you read the liner notes and then you go to the record store next time and you're looking for something by that person.
Right,
and
right.
So it just evolves from there.
Yeah, but that still, for me, seems extraordinary in terms of not being a musician. Were you attracted in at any way to play the music first?
Well, you know, I tried as a kid.
Uh-huh.
In junior high school, my grandmother bought me a trumpet.
Okay.
And so I played the trumpet for a while. You know, I guess I was one of those kids who preferred to be out in the street playing ball.
Okay.
To sitting at home practicing.
Right.
That's why I admire those of you who become musicians, because you took the opposite side and you were the kid who was home playing and practicing
right.
where everybody else was playing ball.
Okay.
Well, you know, I wasn't interested in practicing, I guess, so not being diligent enough in that regard, you know, I got away from actually playing the music.
All right, so let's fast forward, because I want our listeners to get to know you as far as what you do now.
Mm-hmm.
And in the name of jazz.
What I do now?
Yeah.
Well, you know, back when I was in college, I started writing about the music, and that's been the foundation as a writer, a journalist, critic, slash critic, however you want to call it. Been doing that for many, many years, both locally, nationally, and internationally in publications, large and small. And that became a foundation. I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio.
Okay.
There was a great club in Cleveland called the Smiling Dog Saloon. And this was a place where I saw a lot of people, a lot of great people. I mean, you'd have situations like you'd have Mingus would play there. Miles Davis played there for a week. Sun Ra played there for 2 weeks. Mm. Keith Jarrett played there. Weather Report played some of their first gigs there. Okay. Return to Forever played some of their first gigs there. And so this place was really happening. I mean, that this was a place for example, this is where I first met one of my peers growing up in Cleveland, who was Joe Lovano. Okay. And Joe Lovano was a young guy trying out his chops at that time. And his dad played the tenor sax around town. And that place was really a hotbed. But then when that place inevitably passed on to Ancestry, there was a void in terms of touring artists performing in town.
So what I'm hearing is not just the music that drew you, but it was the personalities of the people. So like when Miles was there, you hung out and saw Miles on many occasions.
Yeah. I actually interviewed Miles then.
There you go. Yeah.
And so as a result of the void when that place split, some friends of mine and I got together and we formed the Northeast Ohio Jazz Society.
Oh.
Primarily as a means to fill that void and to present the music. So we started presenting concerts. So that became a gateway to presenting concerts.
Right.
And so, you know, it has all kind of evolved from that point. And then in the mid-80s, there was a gentleman, he was a keyboard player and an educator from the University of Minnesota. He's since passed. His name was Dr. Reginald Buckner. And he did a sabbatical in Cleveland. And during his sabbatical, which was at Cuyahoga Community College, which is the junior college in the Cleveland community, he and another educator there started a jazz festival known as Tri-C Jazz Fest. And that festival was presented primarily as a means of developing a jazz studies program at the college, which it has succeeded in doing. And I was on the organizing committee for that festival. Getting to know Reginald Buckner, I found out in the mid-80s about an opportunity to do what was then known as a needs assessment in the Midwest through an organization called Great Lakes Arts Alliance. And it was a needs assessment to determine the needs of the jazz community. They got a grant from the National Endowment for the Arts to determine the needs of the jazz community in that region.
Right.
And so I went around the Midwest region that they covered, which was Illinois, Indiana, Michigan, and Ohio, interviewing musicians and educators and radio people and presenters and club owners and that kind of thing, about their issues, about the things that they faced in their various communities. So that experience gave me an opportunity to get into arts administration. So that became another pathway. So it's there's all these different doors have opened up at various times.
It seems like the doors connect because as you're talking to those musicians, I'm sure you're finding things to actually write about.
Yeah, because part of that responsibility of doing that needs assessment, out of that, developed a regional jazz newsletter. You know, I was doing essentially oral history interviews, but a lot of those interviews began to appear in this newsletter. So one thing fed another. Through the Northeast Ohio Jazz Society, I became a presenter, got an opportunity to present performances, and that later evolved as well to the point where the Tri-C Jazz Fest and I was on the organizing committee for that 33 years ago, and for the last 17 years, I've served as the artistic director of that festival. Okay. So that's another element of work that evolved out of this whole obsession.
Awesome. Well, let's mention recently you're an author as well in terms of a book that you've written, Randy Weston.
Yeah. I had the great privilege of working with NEA jazz master Randy Weston to write his autobiography. It's called African Rhythms, and we've billed it as composed by Randy Weston, arranged by Willie Jenkins, and it's published by Duke University Press, and it's done very well. That whole relationship evolved very interestingly as well. And the book took 9 years to reach fruition. And, you know, it's funny when you tell people that you're writing a book, you know, it's like you've let the cat out of the bag.
Sure.
Because every time you see them after that, it's going to be, well, how's the book coming? When's the book coming out? How soon's the book coming out, you know? So I spent 9 years with that.
Yeah, they think it's like writing a newspaper article.
Yeah, exactly. I had to explain to them that, wait a minute, neither of us is doing this for a living. I'm still working for a living. Randy's still performing around the world for a living. You know, we take our time to do this when we can.
Exactly.
You know?
Right. But the book was released in...
The book came out in November of 2010.
Well, set up a track, because I think many of our listeners may not have heard Randy Weston.
All right.
So
well,
what should they hear?
Well, his most recent recording was made live at Dizzy's.
Right.
There's a number of different possibilities on that recording. Let's see now. Yeah, you could play High Fly from that record, and High Fly is probably his most noted recording,
and
his most noted composition.
Right, he composed it, exactly.
Yeah.
All right, well, here we go. Randy Weston with High Fly, right here on The Real Deal, 90.9 FM, WDCB. Thank you. there you have it. That was Randy Weston, High Fly. Randy Weston, composer at piano. And we're talking to Willard Jenkins. You said he was the arranger of the book. That's a good one.
Yeah. I guess you could say co-author.
Co-author. Right. Or Randy Weston's autobiography. We're talking here on The Real Deal with Willard about his many jobs, if you will, and passion for the music. Let's talk about your track as an educator. Like, how did that happen, and what are you currently involved in?
Well, I started teaching back when I was still living in Cleveland. I started teaching jazz survey courses and jazz history at Cleveland State University. I did that for a number of years. And just over the last 8 years, I have happily renewed my relationship with my alma mater, which is Kent State University. Mm-hmm. And I'm teaching an online course at Kent State. It's called Jazz Imagines Africa.
You have to tell us about that. The whole imagine, using
imagination. The whole aspect of that course is that, to a great degree, jazz evolved from the African experience in America. Mm-hmm. Of course, we know that the roots of jazz are heavily in the African continent. Mm-hmm. So that's one side of things. On the other side of the Atlantic, if you will, down through the years, we have had many jazz musicians who have, in one way or another, compositionally or performing-wise, imagined Africa in their work.
Right.
Going back even to Duke Ellington's Caravan.
Yes.
And you have elements like Max Roach's Freedom Now Suite.
Exactly.
And Randy Weston's Uhuru Africa. And some of Yusef Lateef's work.
Right.
And Archie Shepp. Mm. And A Night in Tunisia. Right. Dizzy Gillespie and Art Blakey.
Right.
And so you have these various different, as I refer to them, imaginings of Africa, compositionally and performance-wise in the case of American jazz musicians.
Excellent.
And so during the course, we study those various works. And we also deal with certain jazz artists who have gone back across the Atlantic to live in Africa and perform for certain periods of time. You know, for example, Randy Weston and Yusef Lateef both have had extensive experiences living in Africa. And then you had Art Blakey, who spent a lot of time on the continent discovering his Islamic roots.
Yes.
And you have people like Archie Shepp, who spent a lot of time in North Africa. And then you have someone like the Danish guitar player, Pierre Dorigay, who has for a long time had what he calls the New Jungle Orchestra, which also included the South African bassist, Johnny Diani. So in his work, he has explored Africa through the prism of the Duke Ellington tradition, but in his own way.
Okay.
And then, of course, you have, from the African perspective, from the continent itself, you have a tremendous jazz tradition in the country of South Africa.
I was going to ask you about that.
Yeah, South Africa. Yes. I mean, in my research and experience with jazz in South Africa, I've made the case that other than the United States, South Africa has the deepest jazz tradition of any country outside of the United States.
Wow. Because that's something you don't hear often.
No, you don't. But it goes way back. And, I've interviewed South African musicians, and there was one South African musician in particular that I named Hotep Idris Galetta, who passed a couple of years ago. But I had the chance to interview him at the Cape Town Jazz Festival. And I said, well, how is it that jazz is so deep in South Africa? And he said that we all know the most famous South African jazz musician, other than maybe Hugh Masekela and Miriam Makeba's early work, the most important South African jazz musician is the musician who was known as Abdullah Ibrahim, who was formerly known as Dollar Brand.
Dollar Brand, right.
And so Hotep told me the story of how, as a young man, now this was back in the 30s, as a young man, he became known as Dollar Brand because he would go down to the docks in Cape Town when the merchant marines came in, and many of them were African Americans. He would go down to the docks and he would wave dollars to buy the latest recordings. So that's how a lot of the South African musicians got hip to some of the early jazz and through those recordings.
Is that right?
And even, you know, in the depths of apartheid, there was always a jazz tradition in the townships.
Yeah.
And now South Africa has a growing jazz education system.
Right. Yeah, but we tend to take a lot for granted as North Americans, United States citizens. And, you know, Zimology?
Zim and Kana.
Say his last name, right?
Zim Nkana. I cannot do the click side. I don't know the click language. But yeah, the late South African saxophone.
Yeah, he told me to just call him Zimology.
Yeah, right.
We had the pleasure of bringing him to Chicago. Actually, his last performance in the States was with Chicago Jazz Philharmonic.
Ah, okay.
And performed a piece that I wrote in honor of Nelson Mandela's 90th birthday.
Yes.
And Zim told a story about how he would walk for 15 miles just to go hear a John Coltrane record.
Yeah.
And when he got, he'd walk, go to the city, and the guy was like, no, not today. Not today. Come back. And he'd walk back home 15 miles and go back.
And come back the next time.
Just to hear John Coltrane. And I think that that has a lot to do. It's a different hunger.
It is.
A different hunger that we often take for granted.
It is. It is. And you know, it's also interesting that, you know, a lot of times, you know, jazz is now, what we refer to as jazz, is now pretty much a world music.
Yes.
And I say that because, you know, there was a time when American jazz musicians had a monopoly on being able to perform all over the world. And it was like a novelty, you know, this great music, but it only comes from America. Well,
right.
Since that time, other countries have developed their own musicians. They've trained their own musicians. They've evolved their own way of expressing this music through the prism of their own cultures. And consequently, sometimes you find that there is not the same interest in the blues route of the music in other countries, but that blues root still exists in South Africa.
It's because of the experience.
Exactly.
It's the experience and understanding what freedom really is.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Zim and I talked about that a lot.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And when we compare the, you know, pre-civil rights to apartheid and this aspect of that, the music of the culture becomes a reflection of what we go through.
Yeah. Yeah. So, that struggle has a lot to do with what comes out musically.
Wow. Well, one of the things, I was going to save this toward the end. I was going to talk about hope for the future with jazz as the model. Do you think jazz could be a model for change in our society as it was a reflection of what we've gone through?
Yeah, I think so, because it certainly, metaphorically, it certainly has applications for that, because it is a music of change and has always been a music of change and evolution. It's a music that's constantly undergoing an evolution. You know, we have some of my colleagues in the writing profession who gnash their teeth and sit back and decry the fact that to them there haven't been any real changes, as they put it, in the music since Ornette Coleman. But I don't think that's the case. I think the changes have been in other respects, as opposed to someone coming out and playing some startlingly new kind of music. You know, I think changes have come in other ways. Changes have come, in fact, in that aspect that we talked about a moment ago, about these different cultural perspectives coming into the music.
Mm-hmm.
Change has come about as a result of that. So, yes, I think if one were to look at the music and its evolution, one could certainly see metaphorically change relative to societal change as well. And you could also look at the music in terms of a timeline.
Mm-hmm.
You could look at the music and see how certain periods in the music are a reflection of what's happening in society.
Oh, that's right.
You know, because if, for example, you went back to the civil rights era and to the civil slash human rights era in the 60s and 70s and anti-war movement, you heard a certain aspect in the music that reflected that time.
Exactly.
So there's a real yin and yang there.
Exactly. And that's for all the history teachers, all you history teachers out there, this is a perfect example for using music in the classroom, particularly jazz, in teaching American history.
And, you know, that's a good point, Orbert, because we have to point out that there are so many different applications for this music.
Yes.
This music could be taught across various curricula as exemplifying certain aspects, you know. Oh, because at its foundation, I don't have to tell you as a musician that this is a science as well.
Most definitely.
You know what I'm saying?
It is.
And so there are so many different applications across curricula. You know, it's not just about, I don't say that lightly. It's not just about music and the arts. There's a lot of different applications.
Right. And sometimes we have to take the entertainment quotient out of the music.
Right.
And make it a cultural quotient.
You know, exactly.
And understand that.
Because it is both.
Connections. Yeah.
Right.
And those things that cannot be assessed, emotions, feelings.
Right.
You know, certain aesthetics that we need in our society today.
Mm-hmm. You know, absolutely.
Democracy is one. I mean, if politicians could just sit down and watch how a jazz quintet works, we would probably have some.
And, you know, you raise a good point, because also in the case of business,
yes,
there have been business studies that have been done based on the observation of how a jazz ensemble operates.
Exactly.
And how, if you took that relationship of how a successful band operates and applied that to a corporate structure or to a corporate universe, you could, if applied successfully, engender a more successful business model.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And then the other side of it, when we look at musicians that have struggled throughout the history of jazz and set a pace and a standard for how musicians should approach music today, let's say take someone like Dizzy Gillespie. What lesson would you use to teach Dizzy Gillespie outside of the music itself?
That's interesting, because Dizzy Gillespie came along at a time when the music was evolving from the large ensemble universe to the smaller ensemble. Mm-hmm. But even though he was one of those innovators, he kind of went against that tide himself by developing a modern jazz big band. And then he went out and incorporated another strongly related but another cultural tradition in terms of the Afro-Cuban aspect. So, you know, you could look at the multicultural aspect of what Dizzy Gillespie produced and use that as exemplary, as a model.
Right.
You know, so there's a lot of different ways to take someone like him.
Well, let's do that. Let's listen to Manteca.
Absolutely.
Manteca, right here on The Real Deal, 90.9 FM, WDCB. We'll be right back. 90.9 FM WDCB. This is The Real Deal with Orbert Davis, and that was Dizzy Gillespie with Manteca. We're here talking with Willard Jenkins and just about jazz and his world and the future. So, Willard, we're talking about the rich aesthetics of jazz that goes beyond the music. Mm-hmm. What about today's artists? Who knocks you out?
Well, you know, there's any number of people who do because, you know, I do follow the younger artists. I do keep track. I pride myself in that because I know that there are people of my generation and other generations as well who, to me, they tend to get stuck in a rut.
Yeah.
You know, it's the music that they grew up on and, oh, there's been nobody great since John Coltrane.
Right.
Well, that's not true.
Right.
But, you know, I listen to a lot of young people. Like, I was reading something today about a young keyboard player, piano player from out of New Orleans that has been very impressive to me, named Jonathan Batiste.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And the Strickland brothers, yeah. Marcus and EJ. And young bassist Ben Williams from
yes.
out of D.C.
Oh, yeah.
And a little bit older, but still young people, Vijay Iyer, the piano player. And Rudrish Mahantapa, the saxophone player. And and of course,
yeah.
I'm really knocked out by Jason Moran
oh, yeah.
and really thrilled that Jason has been appointed to the Kennedy Center artistic advisor position that was formerly held by Billy Taylor.
That's right.
So there are any number of young people. And whenever someone brings up that tired determination that, oh, the music is dying or the music is dead, you know, I have to say, wait a minute. There are still young people who want to play this music and still have a thirst for playing this music, and they're coming along every day, and they're growing up and learning in a different system than our older musicians did, but they're still coming along and learning the music with a great desire nonetheless.
Right.
And they're out here. I mean, John Clayton's son, Gerald.
Yes.
A wonderful piano player.
Right, yeah.
And the two young guys he has playing with him, Joe Sanders on bass and his drummer. And then there's a young drummer named Jamira Williams. So they're out here.
That's right. That's right.
They're out here. And Gretchen Parlato, the singer. And they're out here.
Well, fortunately, many of the names that you mentioned are favorites on The Real Deal. So.
Oh, good. Kendrick Scott,
that's
drummer,
right.
You know.
And Terry Lynn Carrington.
Terry Lynn, her Mosaic project is an extraordinary project that relates to some of the great things that Billy Taylor established at the Kennedy Center, one of which was the Mary Lou Williams Women in Jazz Festival. And Terry Lynn Carrington has been heavily involved in that for the last few years. And she premiered this Mosaic project at the Mary Lou Williams Women in Jazz Festival. And in 2011, went on to record it for Concord. And it features many of the exceptional women in this music, including some of the great singers like Diane Reeves and Cassandra Wilson and Dee Dee Bridgewater.
Awesome.
But then it also includes some of the younger people like Esperanza Spalding.
Right.
And it includes Jerry Allen. And Gretchen Parlato is on there, and young piano player Helen Sung, who I'm also very impressed with.
Yes, yes.
And it's just a fine recording. And it's, you know, it's interesting. She's been able to come up with this recording in such a way that it's not ghettoized as some kind of women's jazz recording.
Right,
it's not
right.
that way. It's different, you know?
Right. And then there was another musician that we had talked about a little earlier, Marcus Shelby.
Yeah, Marcus Shelby is a bassist out of the Bay Area in San Francisco. And he, like you, still believes in the large ensemble. And thank you so much for continuing to work that.
All right.
Because that's still one of the core sounds
yeah.
of this music.
Yeah.
You know, I still believe that when a large ensemble is really working, there is no greater sound.
Yeah.
in this music than to hear 16 or 17 individuals coming together harmonically
right.
to make music. It's a joyous thing.
Yeah.
And Marcus Shelby works in that large ensemble arena, and he has put out a couple of recordings, both of which have been his tributes to the civil rights era.
Yeah.
And the latest is called Soul of the Movement. And there's a great piece on there called Black Cab.
Black Cab.
And it has to do with the Montgomery bus boycott, when a system of rides was developed to augment the fact that folks weren't riding the bus, but they still had to get to work.
Yeah.
So they had this whole system of black cabs, and that's what this piece is about.
Well, let's hear it. Here's Black Cab, Marcus Shelby, on The Real Deal.
If you need to get to your job in a hurry, never worry. Just call on a black cab. If you need to get to your church and it's raining, stop complaining and call a black cab. I heard through the grapevine to boycott the bus line, and so in the meantime, black cabs will do me just fine. If you need to get to your school way in the boondocks, past the bus stop and grab a black cab. Black cab. I heard through the grapevine to boycott the bus stop. And so in the meantime, black cabs will do me just fine. If you need to get to your school in the boondocks, past the bus stop, and grab a black cab.
I'm Willard Jenkins, and you're listening to The Real Deal with Orbert Davis on WDCB.
All right.
Marcus Shelby and his large ensemble from out of the Bay Area of San Francisco, and Marcus' musical remembrance, although remembrance is an interesting word here because Marcus wasn't born yet,
right.
but this is Marcus' musical tribute. Yeah. To the civil rights era.
But a lot of his music is programmatic. I mean, he did a piece on Harriet Tubman as well.
He did.
Yeah.
There are some guys who, and women, mm-hmm. who look at these opportunities to record as opportunities to do more than just lay down 10 or 12 tracks, but as opportunities to speak to a certain theme. And he's one of those.
All right.
And I tell you, another young artist I'm very impressed with is Robert Glasper.
Yes.
And Robert Glasper's next recording is promising a lot from what I've read. You know, like he's going to be incorporating a lot of different elements across genres because, you know, Robert, he is a highly trained and dyed-in-the-wool jazz musician, as we refer to jazz. Mm-hmm. But Robert has had a lot of experience in the R&B and hip-hop arenas.
Yeah.
You know, he's been the music director for Mos Def and for Maxwell, and he's incorporating all these different people, Music Soul Child and all these different people in his next record. And it's supposed to be quite something. I'm waiting to hear it.
I'm a little nervous because my guest Willard today has sat behind a microphone for over 40 years, he says. So give me some advice. What would you tell me about this this journey? And actually, you are doing a project on jazz radio.
I am. Yeah, I've been doing radio since college. And my radio experience has been in the public radio and mostly community radio arena.
Mm-hmm.
At the moment, I have a program on WPFW in Washington, D.C., which is the Pacifica station in Washington, at 89.3 FM.
All right.
And I have a program on Thursday mornings called Ancient Future. And that's...
You come up with these names, right?
Well, I stole that. That's the name of a book that Randy Weston is kind of... It's a very important book to him.
That's awesome.
It's a book called Ancient Future, written by a man named Wayne Chandler.
Okay.
That deals in part with the somewhat unknown or undercover African experience in ancient China.
Exactly.
A lot of people don't know about that.
I sure don't.
And at any rate, I took this term ancient future for my radio program because that's what I like to do.
Yes.
I like to go from the ancient to the future. I mean, we start off with older music in the first hour, and eventually it evolves to my final hour as known as the new release hour.
I like that.
So that's what that's about. But yeah, you mentioned project. Yeah, I'm doing some research on the history of jazz radio. So all I can say about that is stay tuned.
Yes, we'll keep everybody informed. This is The Real Deal with Orbert Davis on 90.9 FM WDCB. I'd like to thank my special guest, Willard Jenkins, for educating us and especially educating me. I'm ready to go back to the books, do a little reading, do a little studying. And Willard, what would you like to take us out with today?
Well, earlier we played Randy Weston's classic composition, High Fly, from his latest recording, which is called The Storyteller, live at Dizzy's Club Coca-Cola in New York. Like to go out with one of those because, you know, I've been in the Randy Weston mode for these years writing this book, and the book has done very well, and we've done book signings all over the country, so I'm in that mode. So let's hear one of his more recent compositions, also from his latest recording, The Storyteller, and it's called Loose Wig.
All right.
And he wrote that as a result of one day being stuck in a subway under the East River. And he said people were going nuts. So he wrote this piece called Loose Wig.
All right. I love the inside track. That's what you get right here on The Real Deal. Well, thank you so much, Willard. We'll see you soon.
Such a pleasure. Thank you, Orbit. Thank you.